here to the workshop, to the holographic cosmology workshop.
Holographic cosmology is not quite a contradiction in terms, but it's close. It's a field. It's a field very much in its infancy. In particular, it's a meshing of two things which don't yet fit very well together. We don't really have much complete formulation of a holographic cosmological theory. So today I'm going to have more emphasis on holography than on cosmology, but I'll try and explain why I think the particular aspects of holography I'm going to be describing today are relevant and useful as something that cosmologists might want to think about. Holography is the gold standard of the physics of quantum gravity. It's an area in which we really know, in principle, what are the rules in certain circumstances. So by holography, I mean an exact correspondence between a sharply well-defined field theory on some lower dimensional boundary of space-time, on the one hand, and the full quantum mechanical dynamics of gravity in the bulk of space-time. And we have reason to believe that any consistent theory of quantum gravity ought to obey the holographic principle. The original arguments in favor of the holographic principle are completely model independent. They have nothing to do with some particular model or theory of quantum gravity. They're absolutely universal. So we believe, or people who are interested in the subject, most of us believe that the rules of holography are general rules that apply to everything. All right. Cosmology, cosmology at the moment is a very theory-dependent subject. At the moment, cosmology consists of a number of models, of disconnected models, which have very little to do with each other, and in many of which we don't really know how to do calculations in a fully principled way. And one of the great things I'm hoping will come out of this workshop will be an understanding of how that might be achieved. So I will be talking today about how holography can be used to derive completely general, completely rigorous, robust facts about quantum gravity of the sort that might be useful for studying cosmology, and of which we can be very, very confident, and which have no real way of proving these ideas, or no currently known way of proving these facts or these theorems from the conventional point of view of bulk gravity. All right. So here's the kind of question you might want to ask. So in four-dimensional gravity theories, there are a million theories of gravity. You know, everybody has a theory of gravity these days. So Java, Lifshitz gravity, infrared modified, degravitation, whatever, ghost condensation. Everybody has their own favorite theory of gravity, and since everyone has their own favorite, everyone's free to make up their own rules, right? There are no rules. Gravity is what my opinion says it is. Let 100 flowers bloom. What could go wrong with that? We know that there may be some limitations. For instance, in the class of 4D gravity theories, can we really have pure gravity? Can we really have pure gravity? Well, that might be difficult, because we know that in a consistent theory of quantum gravity, there are big black holes, and big black holes have quantum states, a lot of quantum states, too many to be accounted for by just the gas of gravitons. So where are all these quantum states coming from? I don't know. You know, if we're talking about pure gravity, then I don't know. They gotta come from somewhere, but I don't know where exactly. Okay, so maybe gravity can't be exactly pure. Okay, maybe. But why not? What goes wrong if you try to make gravity too pure? And how impure does it have to be consistent? Well, I don't know. No. I mean any theory of gravity and matter. Anything that contains gravity. I'm talking... Oh, but pure... Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry. I misunderstood the question. Yeah, so pure general relativity. Is it possible to have pure general relativity with nothing else in it? You know, Lily...
Sure. With only gravitational degrees of freedom.
Yeah. Okay, but how far up can I go?
That's right.
How far can I go? Can I go to... Well, okay, so if I think,
in my opinion... Well, let me take a poll. If I go to the energy scale of 10 to the quintillion times the Planck mass, can I get away with having pure general relativity and no other states up to that scale of 10 to the quintillion times the Planck mass?
Who here thinks that I can extend pure general relativity that far? Raise your hands. Who here thinks that you can't extend pure general relativity that far?
Oh, okay.
Raise your hands. Who here thinks they don't know? Okay, good. There's a variety of opinions. That's in four dimensions. What about three dimensions? What do people think about three dimensions? Who here thinks that you can extend a theory of pure gravity to such a high energy scale in three dimensions?
Is there a UV completion of gravity, pure gravity?
Right, of pure gravity without extra states. Okay, so one vote for yes.
There's no gravity in three dimensions.
Well, by gravity, I mean quantum general relativity in three dimensions. Yeah, I agree. It's a little bit funny because there's not the usual Newton force. Though with negative cosmological constant, which is what I'll discuss, it's a bit more gravitational. So who here thinks that you can't extend it that far in three dimensions? So who here thinks maybe? So that's interesting. So people think in three dimensions, it may be easier to extend three-dimensional gravity to such a high scale. Okay. Well, I'll make a mental note of that, and I'm just going to write it down. I don't want to embarrass anyone later.
Perhaps you meant we should have known better.
Yeah. We'll find it. So the
more general question is, what is the highest scale to which the effective theory of pure gravity can be extended without adding additional states? It's hard to answer. We don't know what quantum gravity is in general. We don't have a definition of what quantum gravity is. So what are we left with? We're left with opinions. We all have our opinions. But if in some cases, we do know what quantum gravity is, in particular for a theory of gravity with ADS ground state. And that is a development that's really, in a lot of ways, revolutionized the field of quantum gravity in the last 10 to 12 years or so. So for lambda less than zero, negative cosmological constant, we know that a theory of quantum gravity is the same thing, the exact same thing as a conformal field theory on the boundary of space-time. And this has nothing to do with string theory. This is, you know, something that string theorists, the people, like to think a lot about. But it's now, you know, widely believed that this correspondence doesn't intrinsically have anything to do with string theory. It's string theory gives a particularly tractable set of tools for studying it. But that's probably the best working definition. But now a lot of them have stopped doing string theory. So that might lead to a self-inconsistent definition. We should work on that definition and make sure it makes sense. What's that?
So that's a cost.
Isn't it true that there are corrections to the correspondence if you just take it like that? Correspondence is exact.
It's exact. I mean, it's quantum mechanical on both sides. I'm not saying classical gravity on the right hand side, but when both sides are considered as fully quantum mechanical, then yeah, it's sort of unmodified.
So how do you do quantum mechanics of the gravity state?
Right. So that's quite a good point. So in situations where we do know how to compute quantum corrections on the gravity side, then we can extract more refined information. But in some cases, let's put it this way: if we have a working concrete definition of a quantum gravity theory, then it must be equivalent to a conformal field theory on the boundary. The only examples we really have of such things currently, or the most fleshed out examples, are string theories. As you point out, you might hand me some effective field theory of gravity, or gravity plus matter, or gravity plus an inflaton, or something, and with a negative cosmological constant, and you might say, what's the conformal field theory that corresponds to this? And I say, well, how do you compute quantum corrections on that side? And you say, I don't know, you tell me, you're the conformal field theorist. But then I say, no, it doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that. I don't know that this effective field theory you gave me, I don't know that that corresponds to that can be completed to a fully quantum mechanical theory of gravity. So what I'm going to be talking about today is the beginnings of the application of the ADS-CFP correspondence as a diagnostic for the UV completability of a low-energy effective theory of gravity and matter. So you hit on the key idea here. Right.
So in principle, if Joma wants to hand me a theory of pure gravity that has a gap above gravitons, that has nothing but gravitons and then maybe a massive state at 10 to the quintillion times the Planck mass, and then he wants to say to me, hey, what's the conformal field theory corresponding to this? I can say, well, there aren't any conformal field theories with the right spectrum. So I think that effective field theory you handed me cannot correspond to a consistent theory of gravity. Okay, so that's the use to which we're going to put the ADS-CFP correspondence in this talk, just in a very rudimentary example. But I think it illustrates a principle that can really be exploited further and should be exploited further. That it can be exploited further. Well, I guess that's a good question. So if it were an effective theory of some consistent theory of gravity, then you could always ask, well, so what happens when you turn the crank of the ADS-CFP correspondence? There really is a general machinery in which one takes gravitational correlators in the bulk and turns them into CFT correlators on the boundary that obey by essentially automatically all the axioms of CFT. There are a couple of asterisks on that, and I think those asterisks have been improved a bit. Let me defer that to the very end. But I think the map I think the map from gravity to the gauge theory is by far the better, more the direction in which we have the most confidence. So the contrapositive of that correspondence is to say that if there's no CFT, then there really should be no theory of quantum gravity. So we might like to do something like scan over the space of all three-dimensional CFTs and say, what's the maximum mass gap among all theories of quantum gravity with negative cosmological constant? And the question of the maximum mass gap, the reason I'm focusing on that, apart from the fact that it's what I can do, is it's closely related to the size of non-renormalizable operators in the lower dimensional effective field theory. And particularly in theories of large field inflation and things like that, bounding the size of non-renormalizable operators is quite important for phenomenological questions. The question of the biggest mass gap you can achieve in a consistent theory of gravity is a really basic kind of central question about the landscape. So in practice, it's hard to do this for a couple of reasons. The most obvious reason is that there's no definition of mass gap in finite volume, and ADS is a finite volume theory as long as lambda is not quite zero. So for ADS at finite radius, there's no canonical way to read off the mass gap from the spectrum of the corresponding CFT. Second, we don't know much about conformal field theories, so it's a hard program to carry out in practice. We know a great deal about special classes of CFT, supersymmetric ones, factorized, integrable. There are all sorts of classes of CFT that we know a great deal about, but not so much about characteristics of the entire landscape of CFT. That, someday I hope we will, but at the moment we don't know nearly as much as we would like or as we would need to carry out this program in full. So both of these difficulties are easier to deal with in the case of two-dimensional CFT. So we're going to dial back our ambitions a little bit and ask about three-dimensional gravity. So we're going to try to learn about the maximum mass gap for a theory of quantum gravity with negative cosmological constants in three dimensions. So for two reasons. One, there is a clean definition of the gap. So there is a clean separation between multi-graviton states on the one hand and massive states in the bulk on the other hand. It's a representation theoretic separation. So you can make it completely sharp. And second of all, the landscape of CFT is, I would say, somewhat better understood in two dimensions than in any other dimension. Not completely well understood, but we just have more tools. The tools perhaps are better developed in the two-dimensional case. Okay, so in three-dimensional gravity, there are no graviton states that propagate in the bulk of spacetime. That's what makes the question a lot easier. For lambda less than zero, we have only these things called boundary gravitons or boundary metric excitations that just circulate as free particles at spatial infinity. So in three dimensions in ADS, there's no such thing as gravitational radiation. There is only gravitational angulation. So each angular momentum mode with mode number greater than or equal to 2 can be occupied by an arbitrary number of boundary gravitons, each of which has energy absolute value of n over L, where L is the ADS radius, it's equal to the square root of the absolute value of the cosmological constant. So, by the way, note that, was there a question? So note that n starts at 2. There are no graviton modes that live no graviton excitations of the vacuum that live in the n equals 1 mode. That just corresponds to the familiar fact that there's no such thing as a dipole mode for the graviton. Those would correspond to boosting the vacuum. So as excitations of the vacuum, they're pure gauge. If there's an excited state, if there's some matter in the bulk, then adding one of these n equals 1 boundary gravitons is just boosting the massive state to a higher state of motion. So in terms of the two-dimensional CFT, the states with boundary gravitons excite. Yeah, I should have said global ADS. Well, so it's acting with L sub minus 1 is a boost. Yeah, it's a funny thing, but it's true that even in compact ADS, there is such a thing as a boost. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Because there are no gravitons, there's a clean definition of the mass gap, which is just to say the lowest state, other than the boundary graviton states, which have a spectrum that's independent of the theory. So if you just remove those states from the spectrum, or if you factor them out of the partition function, the lowest non-vacuum state you're left with, we'll call the energy of that thing the mass gap. So
in terms of, I'll explain basically now in terms of conformal representation theory how you do that. So in terms of representation theory, the states with boundary gravitons excited or boosted from the rest frame are called descendant states. So they're things which, a primary state in the conformal field theory is the thing that has the lowest energy in its conformal family. And all the descendant states are things that you can make by raising the energy with positive energy operators of the conformal algebra. So the states at rest with no boundary gravitons excited are the primary states. So these L minus 1s correspond to the energy raising boost, and L sub minus n for n greater than or equal to 2 is a boundary graviton creation. So in two dimensions, we understand CFT fairly well. And it's interesting that before we go all the way into our bound, in certain special classes of CFT, a bound on the gap is actually known. So this is the work from 2007 to 2008 by Witten, following up on work by Hoehn. So when the Hilbert space of the CFT completely factorizes into a product of left and right moving states, then it's possible to prove that the weight, so H stands for weight in conformal field theory usually, that the weight of the first primary operator is less than or equal to C over 24 plus 1, where C is the central charge of the Virasoro algebra. It's a certain number that appears in the central extension of the algebra. And same for the left moving weight. And furthermore, this is the best possible bound for holomorphically factorized CFT. The extremal CFT, so there was a family of CFT that was more or less up to modulo asterisks that was constructed by Witten and Hoehn, that saturate this bound. Okay, so it's a clue that there are some general inequalities of this type. But it's only true for these holomorphically factorized conformal field theories. By holomorphically factorized, I mean literally the partition function, the finite temperature partition function on the torus, literally factorizes as a product of a holomorphic factor and an anti-holomorphic factor in terms of their dependence on the complex structure. Okay, so and that always happens when the Hilbert space breaks up completely as a product of left and right moving excitations in the conformal field theory. But that is absolutely not generic for two-dimensional conformal field theories. It is almost never true that the Hilbert space breaks up as a product of left and right moving excitations. So, but we would like to take the underlying general principle and generalize it to the non-factorized case, to generic conformal field theories, which would then give us some interesting bound for generic theories of quantum gravity plus matter in three dimensions. that's where we're going with this. And the holomorphically factorized case gives us a hint that we might be able to do this. So questions so far? I don't want to dwell too much on the conformal field theory technology for those who already understand it, and I don't want to zip through it too much for people who don't know it too well. I think what I'll say is that if there's any conformal field theory technology question that people feel is important to understanding what's going on, please stop me and ask, and I would like to explain it. But we're aiming at a kind of mixed audience here, so. Oh, so right. So how does it translate? Yeah. So I have the dictionary a little bit lower down in the talk, but so I might get the numbers wrong here. I have correctly on the slides, but so the total scaling dimension of an operator is H1 plus is H plus H tilde, where H is the right moving weight. And H tilde is the left moving weight. The map between operators, between weights of, between the dimensions of operators and masses of states in the bulk is, mass of the state equals dimension of the operator over L, where L is the ADS radius, and then there's some universal number there, which might even be 1, but I don't remember what it is. And by the way, people might notice, for those who aren't too familiar with CFT, might notice that I'm using the word states and operators almost interchangeably, and that might strike you as weird, but it's not weird. In conformal field theories, there's a one-to-one correspondence between states of the CFT on the circle and local operators. Okay. So I will use the two almost completely interchangeably. Yeah. I'm sorry. I was thinking of the state at rest, but yeah. And ultimately, we're going to be interested in primary operators. So I should have said that. Yeah. Thanks. Yes. Yeah. Sorry. Very, very good question. So when I say mass gap, I mean excluding the graviton states. I mean the mass of the first massive particle that is not included in the multigraviton states. A general theory of gravity plus matter. By the mass gap, I just mean the mass of the first state that is not a multigraviton state.
So multigraviton state would include black hole or like these ones?
Well, the multigraviton states are known, no, they don't have enough entropy to be a black hole. Their entropy is known to be too small. You can count the spectrum and the way they grow with energy, and there just aren't enough states to be a black hole. So very, very good questions, and thank you for those. Anyway, stop me with good questions like that if need be going forward.
So what is the general principle that we'd like to extend to a more generic situation? The underlying principle is modular invariance. So modular invariance is this. So if we have a quantum field theory of any kind in two dimensions living on a circle, so this circle has radius r, so sigma 1, that's the coordinate around the circle, is identified with sigma 1 plus 2 pi r. Okay. And we want to compute the thermal partition function, so z of beta.
is defined in the usual way as a trace of e to the minus beta h. Well, we know on general principles that that thermal partition function is equal to the path integral of the theory on the torus. Okay, I'm not drawing this torus very well, but this is 2 pi r, and this direction here, Euclidean time direction, is beta. So the path integral of the quantum theory on this torus is equal to this thermal partition function. And that has nothing to do with conformal field theory or gravity or anything. It's just a fact. So we also know that if we exchange beta with 2 pi r, then we should get exactly the same quantity. It's just the same, it's the same path integral, so we should get the same number. So that is what I mean by modular invariance. There's a bit more to modular invariance than that, but that's all that we're going to need or use in the talk. Sometimes it's called the modular S transformation. And conformal field theorists sometimes define this quantity tau equals I beta over 2 pi. And in terms of that imaginary number, the modular invariance is just tau, I beta over 2 pi r. In terms of that number, modular invariance is tau goes to negative 1 over tau. Okay? That implements that that interchange. And it's that principle, the principle of modular invariance, that in the case considered by Witten and Finn, ends up forcing the sort of bound on the weight of the lowest primary that they discuss. You don't even need the full modular group. Yeah, that's right. You may need it for. Yeah, I don't think you might need it. You might need it. We'll assume it, but I don't remember where you use it. We'll assume that.
L minus L bar.
Yeah. Okay. So you do. You're right. We'll assume it, but I'm not going to talk about it. The other part of modular invariance is just the assumption that momentum is quantized in the usual units. So it's not momentum in the boundary sense and angular momentum in the bulk sense have the usual quantization rules. It's no more than that. Okay. So it's nothing exotic. So a CFT that is not modular invariant displays various pathologies. It's not even really a CFT. All sorts of bad things. Non-quantization of angular momentum. In the bulk, there's gravity without black holes. There's electromagnetism without charged states. Moduli without massless fields. All sorts of sort of nonsensical physics. So we're going to assume modular invariance from now on, and most people count that as part of the definition of a CFT, at any rate. So what does modular invariance do? Well, it imposes an infinite number of equations on the partition function. And I will show you explicitly, very, very explicitly, how you use these equations to derive constraints on the spectrum. So for PI, modular invariance says that the derivative with respect to log beta, yeah.
So if I just think mainly of the field theory, finite temperature.
Yeah.
So say if I have fermions in the field, don't I impose like antiperiodic boundary conditions for fermions in the beta direction and so forth? So I mean, if the boundary conditions are different in the two directions, why should I have modular invariance?
Right. So the modular invariant theory comes from taking a sum over boundary conditions. Okay. So it's the idea of modular invariance is a kind of way of encoding the locality of the field theory. And it's saying that you shouldn't really just pick a boundary condition and impose it. That's a kind of non-local thing to do. So that any boundary condition that the dynamics would allow has to be one of your allowed set. And that's why you get a modular invariant combination when you sum over boundary conditions.
Yeah, so I mean, there are those type of theories which are like affiliation theories versus based on high possibility. That's a different way. Some of these factors on the generalization will be just not through.
I was going to have a third block for future directions. Yeah, I have some work in progress addressing exactly this question. What replaces modular invariant for scale invariant but non-relativistic field theories? And there is, at least in some cases, I'm still working on examples, in some, the examples make it clear that there is an answer, that there is a version of it. But yeah, that's a great question. The
condition of modular invariance imposes an infinite number of equations on the partition function at this special temperature, beta equals 2 pi. And that special temperature is the temperature where the torus on which the path integral is formulated is a square. It's the fattest possible torus. The two radii are just exactly equal. And so there are an infinite number of conditions on derivatives of the partition function at that temperature. When they're all of this form. Partial with respect to log temperature of raised to the pth power acting on the thermal partition function equals 0 at beta equals 2 pi. I've set r equal to 1. Forgive me for that. Sorry. So these identities are derived by expanding the equation z of beta equals z of 4 pi squared over beta right around the fixed point. Okay, so if you take that equation for expressing modular invariance and you expand it around beta equals 2 pi plus a little bit, you just exactly generate this infinite hierarchy of identities on the partition function. So I'm going to call this the medium temperature expansion of the equation expressing modular invariance, because it's right at the most medium possible temperature between high and low temperature. So the first order condition of modular invariance, P equals 1, is that the average energy equals 0 when beta equals 2 pi. And that is true in any modular invariant conformal field theory. So more generally, at higher odd order in P, exactly. At beta equals 2 pi, the thermal contribution precisely cancels the Casimir contribution. And among other things, that tells you in an indirect way that in any sensible conformal field theory, the Casimir energy is always negative. And that can be proven by other means as well, using the Virasoro algebra, but it's good to see it verified this way. So more generally, at higher odd order P, the condition is of this form. So it's that the thermal average of some polynomial of the energy is equal to 0. So this polynomial is defined by this equation. It's just the e to the plus 2 pi e times that logarithmic derivative raised to the pth power on e to the minus beta e, about all evaluated in the end at beta equals 2 pi at medium temperature. Convenience. Oh, you mean because p is always odd? There are other, later on there are applications where sometimes you consider even orders of things, so then it's the signs work out. But at intermediate points you use it. I mean, because basically you get this proof by contradiction by asking what would happen if it weren't zero, and then so it's useful to have an actual normalization for it. So the first two polynomials are this. The first is just 2 pi e. The second is some cubic polynomial in e. And using these polynomials, we're now going to show that the first and third order equations for modular invariants cannot be satisfied simultaneously if the first excited level is too high compared to the absolute value of the vacuum energy. So, and it's a kind of magic. It just uses very elementary ideas. So we can isolate the vacuum level from the excited levels. So this is the sum over excited states in the partition function. And the thing on the right is the contribution of the vacuum level. So now we take these two equations and we divide them. Okay, so we see that these two ratios are equal. Notice we just canceled the minus signs there. Didn't do anything tricky. Okay, and the right-hand side, by definition, is the ratio of F sub 3 of E naught to F sub 1 of E naught. And which is just this quadratic function of the energy. And that ratio, that quadratic function, we're going to call I sub 3, 1 of the vacuum energy. Because it's the ratio of the third order thing to the first order thing. Okay, now, what are we going to do? We're going to write out explicitly what the numerator and denominator are. So the numerator is just this sum of F sub 3 of E times the exponential. The denominator is the same thing with F sub 1. And it's just the sum over excited levels. Remember, we'd already isolated out the vacuum level. And it's equal to this particular quadratic function of the vacuum energy. Okay, now what do we do? We take this F sub 3, and we rewrite it as F sub 3 over F sub 1 times F sub 1. We just cancel the denominator. Then we take that over there, okay, and we have an equation which only involves, well, which mostly involves, which involves F1 and this ratio, I sub 3, 1, which remembers this quadratic function of the energy. This explicit quadratic function, we have this nice equation. Okay. Now subtract from both sides, multiply through by the denominator, and we get an equation which we can manipulate without too much difficulty by bringing this quadratic function inside the sum. Remember, it was outside. Now we bring it inside on the right. Change dummy indices. We see that dummy index there, the flashing one. We're going to change it to M. See, we just changed from N to M. I want to do all this explicitly because sometimes people think there's some funny business going on here, that I'm using some special trick or special technique, but I'm not. This is all just elementary calculus and algebra. And we group like terms. Okay. So now we have a sum over some F sub 1, which is a linear polynomial in the energy, times an exponential, times this difference, quadratic function of the excited energy minus quadratic function of the ground state energy. And we're going to think about the sign of these terms. So what happens? So we're going to derive a universal inequality from this identity. So this ratio, as we saw, is given by this quadratic function of the energy. Fixing E naught, so we fix the vacuum energy, which is just the Casimir energy, as Dilma reminded us. The roots of this equation, the vanishing of the green quantity in parentheses, occurs when, of course, E equals E naught, or E equals 3 over 2 pi minus E naught. And by the way, E sub plus is positive, because in the unitary theory, the Casimir energy is always negative. So the ground state energy is always negative automatically. So now, if an energy is greater than E plus, then this green quantity, the difference of these green quantities, is always positive. And F1 is always positive, obviously, because 2 pi E is just linear in E. So if E is greater than E plus, then both of those terms are positive. Okay. So now, what do we get? We see that this sum over the green difference times those two blue quantities has to be equal to 0. But these things, okay, are all positive for E greater than E plus. And the sum is one contribution for each excited level. So that means if every excited level is greater than E plus, then the left-hand side of the equation from the medium temperature modular identity is strictly positive. So if every excited level is greater than E plus, then every term in that series is strictly positive. But the right-hand side is 0. That's a contradiction. So some level in a consistent conformal field theory, some excited level, not the vacuum, but some excited level must be less than or equal to E sub plus. And since E sub 1 is the lowest excited level by definition, it follows E sub 1 must be below E sub plus. So we derive the universal inequality on the energy of the lowest excited energy level in a CFT. Sweep that intermediate step out of there, and we put a nice box around it. So it's a universal inequality for a unitary modular invariant CFT with discrete spectrum. Actually, the spectrum doesn't even really have to be discrete. Written in terms of operator dimensions, it says that the dimension of the first non-identity operator is lower than C total over 12 plus 0.477465, which is 3 over 2 pi. For low central charge, the bound is actually pretty good. So, for instance, for C equals C tilde, for the C equals 1 CFT, we have C total equals 2. And delta plus, the first, the lowest non-identity operator, has dimension 0.644131. Okay. So it's pretty good, actually. The largest value of the gap that can be attained is attained at the self-dual radius. And it comes out to 1/2. So 1/2 is less than 0.644131, but it's not obscenely less. You know, it's a pretty tight bound in that sense. We come pretty close to the best we could do for the C equals 1 conformal field theories. I'm certainly assuming unitarity. Because unitarity translates to just literally unitarity of the bulk theory.
Besides this particular, I
just mean that if the bound had been, you know, the bound is close to the best that you could attain, because the bound, we couldn't make the bound lower, like we couldn't make it delta 1 is less than
0.473, because that would be untrue for C equals 1. For C equals 1, delta 1 is equal to a half. So it's just a measure of the idea that this bound is fairly robust. It's not grossly understating the tightness of the constraints.
But can I ask a further follow-up on that? Just playing around.
Please do, yeah.
I mean, but how often do we have a sense for what in generic class of in various classes of theories, what the lowest energy state is, and what delta one can, besides this, what else it often could be?
Yeah, we don't, other than these low central charge CFTs like C equals one, we don't have a great sense of how CFTs behave. But we're going to see later on, we're going to translate the general bound into a gravitational statement, and we'll get another sense that it's probably not too far off from the best you can do. But it'll be that will be more clear in the gravitational language rather than the conformal field theory language. One more thing I can say is that in the holomorphically factorized case, where it's known what is the best you can do, at least with these considerations, the best they can do there is C total over 24 plus 1. And here we're getting C total over 12 plus 1. So at least within a factor of 2, it's close to the best you can do. And who knows, maybe the factor of 2 is really the best you can do for generic CFT. Maybe it can be improved. We don't know. But it's not like, it doesn't go quadratically in the central charge. So we're doing OK.
Well, in the
generic case, it's plus 3 over 2 pi. In the holomorphically factorized case, it's C over 24 plus 1.
Right.
Yeah. But in our case, it's C over 12 plus 3 over 2 pi. But now, this isn't even quite the final bound. So for C total greater than about 18.27, the bound is uninformative, because we have not yet restricted our attention to primary operators. We just derived a bound for the lowest operator, the lowest excited state in general. But in general, there's always a stress tensor which has dimension 2. Okay, so if the bound doesn't tell you, if the bound is above 2, if the bound you derive this way is not less than 2, then you haven't learned anything, because there's always an operator of dimension 2. So we need to adapt this technique to derive a bound that applies to primary operators in particular. And it works for arbitrarily high values of the central charge. So I won't beat this to death. It's a bit technical. But basically, the proof proceeds entirely in parallel. There are a couple of simplifying assumptions that the central charges are greater than 1, and there are no purely holomorphic operators. They're not essential, but the proof is longer and more tedious without them. So basically, the idea is that we understand the representation theory of conformal states for C greater than 1. We understand it well enough that we can write a general formula for the partition function in terms of the energies of primary states alone. That's the thing that makes it tractable. So the full partition function, Z, is equal to this thing, B. That capital B represents the contributions of the conformal family of the identity. So the conformal representation of the identity is that. Which N do I use? This function Y represents just the partition function over primary states alone. So we define that. We define a partition function over non-trivial primary states alone. And then this M is the dressing function, the thing that takes a primary and includes all of its descendants under the conformal algebra. And the full partition function can be decomposed exactly this way, at least as long as C is greater than 1 and the representations of the primaries are therefore known to be basically a free representation of the Virasoro algebra. So it's a very simple decomposition because of that. So then you can just crank through basically the same machinery, define these same polynomials, f sub p, where this function eta is essentially, that's a partition function over over these boundary graviton states, and can also be thought of as the character of the Virasoro algebra. It's known as the Dedekind eta function. So it's a well-known function that expresses the a partition function for the weights of the Virasoro algebra. And then these polynomials have some explicit expressions, which I won't dwell on, but it's good to see that they're not some mysterious things. So this R20 is a certain number defined in terms of derivatives of the Dedekind eta function. All right. So proceeding in parallel with our warm-up proof, we go through exactly the same steps, and we see that the dimension of the lowest primary state is less than or equal to red delta plus, where red delta plus is the largest root of this cubic equation, where b and f were just these functions defined on the previous page. They're defined right here. So f is these f's are defined here. B's are defined in terms of the f's. There's some polynomials. And delta is the largest root of this cubic equation. It's just a cubic equation. And E naught is the vacuum energy shifted by 1 over 12 for various, just for convenience again. So then you can expand this upper bound, delta plus, at large central charge. And what you find is it goes as C total over 12 again, plus this number, 0.473695, which is actually quite close to 3 over 2 pi. It's not too far off at all. It's a little bit lower, in fact. So, okay, so I clicked too far. So you might be asking, you only took the third order equation for modular invariance, the third order expansion for modular invariance at medium temperature. Why didn't you go farther? Why didn't you use the fifth order and seventh order and learn all the new information you could learn from that and maybe get a tighter bound? Are you lazy, sir? Is what you may be asking at this point. The answer is no, I'm not. But it turns out that the extra information you get from the higher orders is not terribly does not improve the bound dramatically. It improves it very marginally. By at large central charge, it improves it by an amount that goes as square root of C rather than improving the coefficient in front of C. So it's not a terribly great improvement. At large central charge, the third order of the expansion really gives you the best of what you need. So that's our universal inequality for primary operators. It's qualitatively similar to the Witten bound in the special case of homomorphically factorized CFT. But in our case, it's completely general, so it can be applied to any conformal field theory that's holographically dual to a theory of gravity. That's the virtue of doing these things in full generality. So now we'll come to the dictionary that somebody was asking about before. I forget who it was. So the ADS CFT dictionary for three-dimensional ADS, two-dimensional CFT, is that the total central charge goes as 3 times the ADS radius over the Newton constant, the three-dimensional Newton constant. And that the dimension of a primary operator is the ADS radius times the mass of the corresponding state in the bulk. So if we translate our bound, we find that the mass of the lowest massive bulk state can never be larger than some particular number times the Planck mass, 1 over 4 g Newton, plus some number which is like a Casimir energy in the bulk sense, some number that goes as 1 over ADS, in particular 0.473 something or other over ADS, over ADS length. And this inequality is universal for all theories of gravity and matter in three dimensions with negative cosmological constant. It's exact at finite ADS radius, but it's even better than that. We did all this in the framework of ADS-CFT, where we're in finite volume in the bulk. Okay, there's a, you know, global ADS is a can, and there are things happening in the can. There's a boundary. Things rattle around in the can and interact. And that's part of what makes ADS-CFT a relatively controlled environment to do theoretical physics. But notice that the upper bound we derived on the mass of the lowest massive state really has nothing to do with ADS itself. If we take the limit where the ADS radius goes to zero, we still get a non-empty, non-trivial upper bound on the mass gap. So that is unexpectedly good in some sense. We used ADS as a tool, as a kind of regulator for quantum gravity. But in the end, the inequality we derived, the universal constraint on gravitational physics, is really a constraint on local bulk physics that doesn't have anything to do with the boundary condition. So the conclusions are as follows. We've seen that there's a universal upper limit on the energy to which a theory of quantum gravity and matter can ever be extended, at least with negative cosmological constant. But in the end, it looks like it doesn't have much to do with negative cosmological constant, because this upper bound has a finite limit as lambda equals zero is approached from below. The bound can be proved rigorously with no use of perturbation theory and no semi-classical methods, no assumption of holomorphy or supersymmetry or string theory. We didn't say anything about string theory. This is not dependent on string theory, although, of course, I'm a string theorist, so we're doing string theory by Schmidt's definition, but not really. As lambda goes to zero, as I say, the bound is independent of the boundary condition. It's really about local bulk physics, not about ADS or boundary conditions or anything. And it's very similar in spirit. Some of you may be familiar with the weak gravity conjecture. And I would like to think that this sort of framework can be used to prove the actual weak gravity conjecture. And best of all, only uses elementary methods. As you could see, I did everything right in front of your eyes. There was no hocus-pocus of any kind, no hand-waving. And the methods are modular in both senses. It uses modular invariants, but it's modular in the sense that we can use these tricks to prove a lot of other things. And this has already happened to some extent. So thank you, and let me end there.
So one of the places where ADS-3 always appears in string theory is in Sitar dimensional platforms, where ADS-3 times S-3, right?
Right.
And that, of course, has gravity and lots of other massless fields.
Right.
So any extension of this result?
Well, I mean, the conformal field theory describing the throat of an NS5 ring, and I think that's what you're basically thinking.
Yeah.
It doesn't quite fall in this class because it includes a linear dilaton factor. So it's not a unitary CFT in the strict sense.
That was the next question I was going to ask.
How does continuous spectrum affect?
Right. Yeah. But similarly, I was going to ask you about Louisville. I mean, that's...
Right.
That's...
Right. Yes. So Louisville theory... So these methods don't apply directly to theories with continuous spectrum of operators. However, sometimes they do. So for theories, what can you say? For theories, first of all, which can be approached as a limit uh, of, uh, theories with discrete spectrum, but have a continuous spectrum, the bound still applies just directly. For instance, the singular points in the moduli space of the D1, D5 CFT, this bound applies directly to those. Now, Liouville theory, I think, is not in that category. I think pure, so that theory kind of contains a Liouville sector, right? But pure Liouville theory, as far as I know, cannot be approached as a limit of CFT with discrete spectrum. But, you know, in the end, the discreteness of the spectrum isn't that important. It's really having positive spectral density that allows you to carry the proof through. But then the discrete spectrum does one other thing, which is that it tells you that the weight of the vacuum is zero, right? Which is not true in Liouville theory. That the weight of the normalizable vacuum is zero. But I think that the discrete spectrum is not really so essential. I think these sorts of tricks could very likely be generalized to interesting theories with continuous spectrum.
So these sort of states in the bulk, are they local propagating states, or are they like the gravitons, they're just sort of boundary?
No, they're states that live in the bulk. So anything...
So you're saying that when we say sort of 3D gravity has no local degrees of freedom, you're saying that statement is wrong because you have to state?
No, nobody ever claimed that every theory of 3D gravity has no local degrees of freedom. People have sometimes said that theories of pure 3D gravity
right,
have no local
exactly.
degrees of freedom. Right, but I think the right statement is that there's just no such thing as a theory of pure 3D gravity. There's always something else.
So you always have to propagate degrees of freedom in the bulk.
Well, depending on what you mean by the word propagate. The scale is interesting. Yeah, I said I would come back to that. But the scale at which the new states come in is 1 over 4g. Now, that's pretty close to a scale that you may know is quite important for three-dimensional gravity, which is 1 over 8g, which is the energy at which the lowest BGZ black hole comes in classically. So you may say, wait a second, this is all trivial. The lowest BTZ black hole is always lower than your lower bound, and that's always in the theory. But it's not so trivial, because the lowest BTZ black hole, when you quantize the theory, has quantum corrections. And because the curvature is Planck scale, the quantum corrections are uncontrolled. I mean, they're order one. For a large BTZ black hole, non-extremal, the corrections to the mass are perturbative. But for the lowest BTZ black hole, you have to expect some order one theory-dependent renormalization of the mass. Mm-hmm. And what this theorem says is that renormalization will never be bigger than a factor of two from the classical energy of the BTZ black hole.
So how can you extend this to talk about the weak gravity conjecture? Like, what's the dictionary for charge?
Right, so the dictionary for charge is just charge. So a gauge symmetry in the bulk corresponds to a global symmetry in the boundary. So that's relatively straightforward. So charge is just charge. And so the question is sharply defined. And not only in three dimensions, but in three bulk dimensions, but in four and higher bulk dimensions. There's a question about the CFT, which is sharply well-defined, which is, given a CFT with a global symmetry, say a three-dimensional CFT with a global global U1 symmetry, what is the universal, and let's say that the anomaly matching coefficients, the two-point function of the U1 current, and the central charge, let's fix all of those. Let's fix the parameters. What is the universal upper bound, given those parameters, on the weight of the lowest state that is has non-zero charge under the U1 global symmetry in the CFT? And that's a kind of analog of the question we're asking here. But that translates directly in the bulk into a proof or disproof, if you like, of the weak gravity conjecture, depending on what the answer is. I think these sorts of tricks are beginning to bring some of these difficult questions within reach. These difficult questions are difficult because they require doing quantum gravity in a regime where it is not under perturbative control in the bulk. But it turns out that precisely in that regime, there are boundary tools like modular invariants that can bring these questions under some kind of control.
There's no more questions. Thanks for being a guest.